This is a CBC podcast.
Support for delivery of this podcast comes from the all-new 2008 Cadillac CTS. Be an original. Visit Cadillac.gm.ca.
It's Monday, December 10th. Prosecutors are asking a judge to give Conrad Black a longer prison sentence because of the, quote, stunning lack of remorse he displayed during an interview with the BBC. Currently, the former media baron denies that he has shown a stunning lack of remorse. As far as he's concerned, it's really quite pedestrian. And for that, he's sorry. This is The Current.
Hello, I'm Anna Maria Tremonti. You're listening to The Current. It's been nearly 6 years since police first descended on a then-unknown man's pig farm in Port Coquitlam, British Columbia. The eerie scene that developed, the backhoes working at night, police in hazmat suits, fueled grisly speculation. And the tension only built from there, culminating yesterday with a verdict in the notorious BC pig farmer's trial. Robert Willie Picton now joins the ranks of Canada's worst serial killers. Yesterday, the jury found him guilty of second-degree murder on all six counts. And for friends and family of Serena Abbotsway, Mona Wilson, Andrea Josbury, Marnie Frey, Georgina Pappen, and Brenda Wolfe, the day was almost overwhelming. Kelly Ryan is the national reporter for CBC Radio News in Vancouver. She has been covering this story since the police first began focusing on Robert William Picton, and she was at the courthouse in New Westminster when the verdict came down yesterday. Hello, Kelly.
Hi, Anna Maria.
What was it like in that courtroom yesterday?
Well, it was astonishing, really. I mean, this has been such, I don't know, so long waited for, I guess, that when everybody was out on the plaza outside the courthouse, because a smudging ceremony had just taken place amongst the families who were trying to heal some divisions amongst themselves, and suddenly courtroom officials came out and said, there's a verdict at 11:30, and everybody just scattered. Everybody ran to their places, primarily the families trying to get into the courtroom to see the verdict come down. And then we had this terrible moment of confusion because the court clerk said to the jury foreman, how do you find Robert William Picton on the count of first-degree murder in the death of Serena Abbotsway? And when he said not guilty, it was like the air had been sucked out of the room. Even reporters said, oh, my God. And family members were screaming no, and they were weeping because everybody had forgotten the option of second-degree manslaughter and then, of course, not guilty. So almost everybody missed the next phrase, which was, how do you find him on the count of second-degree murder? And then guilty came down, and there was just such huge relief that washed through that courtroom from all the family members. And yet, for every verdict, every woman, when they first asked, how do you find him on first degree, and the not guilty came back, there were gasps. It was like no one ever got used to the fact that not guilty was going to come out of the foreman's mouth, even though by the time we got through them all, of course, there had been six counts of guilty offered on the second-degree count.
And as we know, the sentence is likely to be just as harsh, but this is now a real point of contention with some families, it sounds like.
Well, you know, on one hand, yes. On the other hand, there is that sense that we got him, right? I mean, for them, he is convicted. He will be put away for life. It is a question, of course, of the eligibility of parole. They're going to speak to that tomorrow in their own victim impact statements, which they'll read before the judge hands out his sentence, which will include his recommendations for parole. So although I think that you're right, in the beginning there was that sense of how can they not have convicted him of first degree, which means he premeditated these deaths, there was also a sense as time passed of triumph that they had won, that their loved ones were vindicated.
I want to ask about the victim impact statements. How important will that be for the families?
Oh, vital, I think. You heard that tape that was gathered yesterday from the news conference and the emotion and people saying, I want to say this to him. And there is that real sense that people want to address Robert Willie Picton very directly on what they have been through on this. There are three family members who will speak from this group of six victims. There are another 14 families who are included in the second trial who want to speak to him as well and who are going to be given the opportunity to at least have their victim impact statements read. And I think for them, this is finally their chance to say to the man who took their loved ones, this is what you did to us, not just to them, but to all of us as well.
He was in the courtroom yesterday, was he?
Yes.
And how did he react?
As Willie Picton has reacted throughout this trial, with almost no expression whatsoever. He was wearing a new sweater. This is about the only change we saw, a gray sweater with sort of a patch on one arm. But he just stood. Now, he stood with his head bowed slightly. Hands were clasped in front of him. Some people thought they saw a glimmer of sadness on his face. I can't speak to that, but very, very little emotion from him as this came down.
Kelly, I want to ask you about what happened last Thursday. There was that a flurry around when the jury had a question for Justice James William. Remind us what happened and what that means.
Well, you know, that's a much more interesting day than anybody knew at the time because we couldn't tell you what was going on behind the scenes. This, of course, is when the jury came back and said, can we find him guilty if we infer he was indirectly involved in the killings? And it came out of an instruction from the judge, which was that if you don't find he pulled the trigger, you can't convict. So they came back and asked that question, and before the jury returned for their new instructions from the judge, he met with the defense and Crown. We couldn't tell you what was said at that point because the judge ruled there was a ban on the publication there. But what he said was, you know, that sentence bothered me from the very beginning. It had been brought to him the week before by the defense lawyers who wanted that added to his charge to the jury. The Crown agreed to it, and Mr. Justice James Williams turned to the Crown before he spoke to the jury and said, you signed on for this, and there was a clanging sound to it from the very beginning for me. And so he went away and came back and said, you know what, I'm going to change my instruction. The defense stood up and said, if you change your instruction at this point, there has to be a mistrial in this case. You have to end this trial right now. You can't change your instructions 6 days into deliberations for the jury. And he said, you know what, I am. This was an error. I'm going to fix it right now, and we'll deal with anything else later on. And so that's when he told the jury that they could broaden what they needed to convict Picton of the murders, that they simply needed to find that he was an active participant, not necessarily the man that pulled the trigger.
That's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary. And of course, there are lots of legal experts who will tell you it is a huge premise for a potential appeal.
So we haven't heard the last of that conversation that the judge had with the Crown and the defense then?
I doubt it very much.
Okay. How is the Crown characterizing these verdicts?
They're happy. I mean, the reality is, as lead prosecutor Mike Petrie said yesterday, we tried him on murder. He was convicted on murder. To us, the degree doesn't matter. The sentence is going to be the same. And, you know, we did what we set out to do.
And the defense?
The defense, always a little bit more difficult to read the defense in this case. They're not quite so blunt in their statements, outside of the courtroom, of course. You know, they said, well, obviously the jury did not believe that perhaps he was as actively involved as the Crown initially tried to make him out to be, and there's some issues there and some questions there, but they really didn't want to talk about either how their client was, their reaction, whether they would appeal this conviction. They basically said today isn't the day to talk about all of that.
Mm. Kelly Ryan, thanks for this.
You're welcome.
Kelly Ryan is a national reporter with CBC Radio News in Vancouver. So the man who told police he was just a pig man will be sentenced tomorrow on 6 counts of second-degree murder. To put the legalities of this marathon case into perspective, we're joined by Janine Benedet. She teaches law at the University of British Columbia. Good morning.
Good morning.
Were you surprised by the verdicts?
Not entirely. I was surprised by the length of the deliberations and a bit surprised that the conviction was second rather than first-degree murder.
Why the length?
Well, we don't know why the length of the jury.
But I mean, why were you surprised that it would take 10 days?
Well, given the strength of the forensic evidence and the confession and the failure of Picton himself to testify, I would have thought that would have presented a pretty compelling case to the jury. And I was surprised that it took them, you know, I mean, obviously they were very careful about their task and reviewed the evidence carefully, but the deliberations were still lengthier than I might have thought.
Mm. And the whole second degree versus first degree murder, what factors would have gone into that?
Well, I think, as you said, there's really only one offense of murder in Canadian law, but murder can become first degree, sort of aggravated for the purposes of sentencing, if you prove one of a whole list of factors, and one of them is that the killing is planned and deliberate, which is what the Crown tried to prove here. And that doesn't require, you know, a lengthy period of pre-planning, but it does require some kind of premeditation, some kind of prior fixed plan to carry out the killing before the moment in which it actually happens. And I would have thought, on the theory of the Crown, that these women were recruited and from the streets and brought to the farm, that there was certainly ample evidence on which the jury might have found that.
Mm. Now, they did have the butchered remains of women from the farm. Why was this so difficult to prosecute?
Well, I mean, you don't have direct, you know, witnesses to the killings themselves. You know, there was an attempt by the defense to say, listen, there were an awful lot of people going in and out of this farm. Individuals who might have been involved in greater or lesser degrees, and here's a man who, you know, the defense tried to portray as intellectually simple, as gullible, and to ask the question, well, you know, where are these other individuals? And I mean, of course, it's not the burden legally of the defense to prove his innocence. They just have to say, listen, there's a reasonable doubt here that he was the one who was responsible.
Now, the only time the jury heard him speak was with the videotaped confession, because he was never put on the stand. How do you think that played to the jury?
Well, I mean, of course, he's got a constitutional right to silence. He doesn't have to take the stand. The defense is entitled to put the Crown to the proof of its case. But, you know, in a case where you've got that degree of circumstantial evidence, you've got the taped confession, you know, the failure of the accused to testify is obviously something from which the jury can draw an adverse inference. They seem to have done that in this case.
Now, I want to ask you a little bit about the whole issue of the judge, of what happened Thursday, and Kelly Ryan was just talking about it. But does that leave an opening for an appeal, this whole instructing the jury on one specific point?
It could be a ground for an appeal that the judge made an error in his charge that so prejudiced the deliberations that it requires a new trial. But I'm not so sure that you want to overstate the importance of that. It's hardly extraordinary for a judge to, in response to a jury question, clarify or even correct instructions that were previously given. And the important thing is that the correction is made before the verdict is reached. I mean, obviously, if the judge made an error that went uncorrected, then that's a clear ground for an appeal. The issue here is whether somehow the correction comes too late in the day, and that's obviously a much less compelling argument for an appeal.
Now, how usual or unusual is it to have that kind of discussion? As Kelly Ryan was telling us, at one point the defense was saying, well, then you're going to have to declare a mistrial. How usual is that kind of a conversation behind closed doors?
Well, it's not that unusual in the sense that when the jury has a question, which happens fairly frequently in complex trials, it's quite typical for the judge to canvass the views of the Crown and the defense as to what response he might give to the question, because if they can agree to what that response is, then again, that's you know, further satisfies the judge that there is no ground for an appeal. So again, I wouldn't say it's common, but it's certainly not unheard of in the Canadian criminal justice system.
Now, the defense had raised questions during the trial related to Picton's mental competence. Could we see that raised again before sentencing?
It's theoretically possible, but highly unlikely. I'm not sure that it's ever been. The Supreme Court of Canada has said it's possible to raise mental disorder at that very late stage. But it's highly unlikely. I'm not sure that it's ever actually been done before. And I suspect that if the defense were going to try to raise a mental disorder defense, they would have done that at the outset as part of the whole case that they put before the jury.
So there's no real advantage in sentencing to do that?
No. And it wouldn't speak to sentencing. It would be an attempt to reopen the proceedings and to now raise a mental disorder plea.
Insanity, in other words.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. What used to be called insanity and what's now called mental disorder.
Okay, but it they didn't get it very far with that before, and it's not going to happen now then.
No, I think that's exactly right. And so the sentencing phase will focus on the period of parole ineligibility, which could range anywhere from 10 to 25 years.
Now, January 17th is the trial date for the next 20 murder charges that Picton is facing. Will we see that go ahead, do you think?
Well, it really depends on a number of factors. There are obviously both legal considerations here, and there are highly personal ones. Each one of those victims was a woman, was a human being, and each death counts, and there should be obviously some form of criminal responsibility reached in each and every one. Legally, if the conviction is either not appealed or if the appeal is unsuccessful, those additional counts won't have any effect on the sentence that Picton serves. And it's certainly possible that it would make sense in a legal fashion to accept some kind of a plea to those additional counts, which would resolve them without the need to have a full trial on the additional 20 counts.
That's interesting, because it almost then becomes political. The families wanting justice versus whether the system needs to go through another trial for this guy where it's already clear what he's done.
That's right, and it depends on how you define justice. If justice is that he will be incarcerated and his chances of ever being released are slim to nil, then justice is served by the single trial. If justice is some sort of erring in a criminal trial process of each and every disappeared woman's story, then you don't have justice until you've gone through all of those cases.
Something for us to watch for then as the weeks go by. Janine Benedet,
that's right.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Janine Benedet is an associate professor of law at the University of British Columbia. She was in our Vancouver studio this morning. Well, that's all we have for this podcast. You can listen to The Current weekday mornings on CBC Radio 1 right after the 8:30 news, as well as on Sirius Satellite Radio 137. To find out more about our program, visit cbc.ca/thecurrent. If you have any thoughts on what you're hearing on The Current, share them with us. Send us your comments. You can email us at thecurrent, all one word, thecurrent@cbc.ca. Our mailing address is Post Office Box 500, Station A, Toronto, M5W1E6. Or call us collect 1-877-287-7366. To subscribe to other great CBC Radio podcasts, check out cbc.ca/podcasting. Thanks for listening. I'm Anna Maria Tremonti.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.